You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Shimon Peres, the Nobel laureate and one of the most revered public servants in the state of Israel, died 1 year ago this month. He held several positions in the Israeli government, including prime minister twice and minister of defense. He had also written many books about the politics and history in Israel. His latest was a memoir, a book that was more revealing and intimate than any other he has written, and he passed away only a few weeks after completing it. No Room for Small Dreams, Courage, Imagination, and the Making of Modern Israel has just been published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings his son, Chemi Peres, to our show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And as we were talking before we went on air, this is the very beginning of your book tour, talking about your father's book. And the memoir starts with your father's childhood memories, probably a part of his biography that is less well-known than his public career. Where was he raised, and what was his childhood like?
So he was raised in a small shtetl, small village called Vishniva in Belarus, in Poland. And he grew up in an ultra-Orthodox family. He left Poland when he was 11 years old with his mother and his brother to realize a great dream to come and live in Israel before there was a state. And when he departed from Poland, he left his first mentor and beloved grandfather, Tzvi, who unfortunately was burned together with his whole family later on by the Nazis in the synagogue in that little town. My father's book is a string of dreams to be realized and greater causes to be served and hard decisions that he had to take through his life. You mentioned all the roles that he had in Israel, but my father was also a president of the state of Israel. This last position was actually for 7 years, and he's the only one who held both positions. And he had three times transitions, one from Europe, from an old world, a world of the ultra-Orthodox family, coming to live in a new land in Israel. And then another transition, which basically my father was one of the founding fathers of the state of Israel and one of the last who participated in the foundation of a state. And then he spoke about transitioning into the future. So my father, through his life, managed to transition himself into tomorrow. And the book is really a remarkable journey, the journey of a remarkable human being, but also a remarkable journey of the state of Israel from pre-foundation until today.
You mentioned a couple of times that your father was raised ultra-Orthodox. Did he hold on to that when he went to Israel?
He did not hold on to being an Orthodox person, ultra-Orthodox person, but when he departed from his family, his grandfather told him, "My son, never forget to stay Jewish." And that was a command and a will that he kept all his life. And this is something that I continue as well, and my family members. We shall stay Jewish forever.
That's a cute, never forget to stay Jewish. What was the fear behind that?
The fear behind it was the unknown, that our dynasty and our religious and our belief and most importantly, the values of the Jewish people will not be forgotten. So he thought that by staying Jewish, he would stay honest to his heart and honest to his mind and honest to his people, and will continue the wonderful legacy of the Jewish people. It's a very ancient people that suffered many times for being torn away from its homeland into the diaspora. And his grandfather wanted to make sure that he would not forget his family and his origin, and forever he should stay Jewish. And he honored that.
Was your father ever conflicted about religion, about how observant he was?
My father really took from the Bible and from the Jewish belief many, many foundations to his thinking and to his vision. He mainly laid upon the prophets of Israel and the moral values that are being omitted and transcended from the Bible, to be moral, to be just. He thought, for example, that the Ten Commandments are the most important document of morality in our world that we should embrace. And their wisdom, and most profoundly, I would say, is the Isaiah vision for not having wars anymore, for not raising swords once against each other, like saying, and they should beat their swords into plowshare, and the rest of the vision of Isaiah, which is now marked on his grave. My father was a great visionary and believer that we are transitioning now from an old world of wars into a new world of science and technology, from a world of territory to the world of mind. And in our history, we have great leaders and great nations that build great empires, but all of them were based on military, war, bloodshed, and all of them took place because the source of power was in the land. It was natural resources, it was territory. And my father believed that as we travel into the future with science, technology, innovation, optimism, and forward-looking, we shall never need military anymore, and we shall never need to learn war no more. Because everything you need basically comes from the brain power. If you need energy, we can invent sources of energy or ways to harness energy. If we need food and water with technology, we can grow food when there is a refusing and dry land. We can purify water. We can reuse water. And basically with militaries, you cannot conquer science and technology. You actually have to invest. So he believed that as we move forward into the future, for the first time in human history, nations will be able to become great not on the expense of others. Or in his words, as he says in the book, you can win without having the other lose. And that's a great vision for the future of Israel, for the future of the region and the world by and large.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopez, speaking with Hemi Perez about his father's last book, a memoir, No Room for Small Dreams, Courage, Imagination, and the Making of Modern Israel. When did your father first get involved with politics?
When he was very, very young, extremely young. He was below the age of 20. And by that time, he already expressed and demonstrated great leadership and charisma. To the point that he was actually spotted by our founding father, David Ben-Gurion, and actually was a rising star. And because of his ability to rise very early, all the old guard of the political party that he was part of was trying to block him and block his way. But Ben-Gurion identified him as a great leader and envisioned that one day he will become the leader of the state of Israel. And Ben-Gurion's door was always open to this young man. And many people ask him, how come that Ben-Gurion keeps the door open for you? And his answer was actually, there were three things that Ben-Gurion knew that when Shimon Peres is knocking on his door will happen. The first one, Shimon will never ask anything for himself. The second one, he will never badmouth anyone. And the third one is that he will always come with a fresh idea and a fresh mind. And Ben-Gurion was the one who was looking for this kind of youth and leadership that both of them came within this young man. And he served Israel throughout his life. He has a record in serving the state of Israel. When he passed away, our prime minister, the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, opened the weekly meeting of the government by saying, this is the first day that Shimon Peres is not part of the life of Israel.
Let's go. Your father, as everyone knows, and as we've been discussing, is part of the firmament and foundation. of the state of Israel. But one of his first big challenges was to put together a military structure in Israel. Can you talk about that and talk about why your father or when he had the idea to ally with the French in order to do all of this?
Yes, absolutely. My father, after realizing his first two dreams, which were coming to live in Israel and participating in the foundation of the state of Israel, immediately there was a call for service issued by Ben-Gurion. And the first cause he served was building the Israeli defense industry and the military. And just like every step in Israel's life as a nation, it had to do with being innovative and bold. In order to make Israel strong in an environment which is not so friendly, my father strived to get his hands on the most advanced technologies that are there around the world. So he was behind the establishment of the nuclear facility in Dimona, and he talks about it in the book. And he was the one who actually launched or started the Israeli aerospace industries dealing with space technologies, when in Israel you did not know yet how to build a bicycle. And of course, he worked on creating Rafael, which is the authority for innovation developing missiles. He was the first one to introduce computers into the military when all the generals says, what do we do with computers? They cannot fire. What role can they play in the battlefield? So he was a great visionary. And the tools that he used all the time were innovation, forward-looking, and really trying to see things way ahead of its time.
So how did the French play into this?
So from very early stage in his life, he had positions in the Ministry of Defense as the right arm for David Ben-Gurion. Initially, he came to live in New York for a while to head the first mission of procurement of different aims and different weapons. But he really wanted to do something significant. And the most significant thing was really to put his hands around nuclear technologies. And the only place that he could really do that was in France. This is where he started to focus on France. Got, of course, to learn the language by himself, made a lot of friends in France, and with an unbelievable way that he describes in the book for the first time in his words, he managed to do probably the ultimate project that I know of, which is the greatest technology to do it under the radar screen with every opposition from every corner around Israel without funding. He managed to put this amazing project to life. And I think that project made Israel so powerful and allowed him later on to start serving the cause of peace.
And I want to get into exactly how your father got this nuclear program off the ground, despite all of that opposition, when we come back from this break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Hemi Peres, the son of former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres, about his father's life and legacy. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. And this is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard. And I'm speaking with Hemi Peres about his father's last book, a memoir, No Room for Small Dreams, Courage, Imagination, and the Making of Modern Israel. And yes, I didn't even mention who his late great father was, Shimon Peres, Nobel laureate, former president of Israel, two-time prime minister of Israel, former defense minister of Israel. And before we went to break, you were talking about how, despite all the opposition in he faced in Israel to pursuing a nuclear program, your father was able to do it. And in the book, he writes about his thoughts on pursuing a nuclear program in Israel. He writes, "The reputation of nuclear is deterrence. And deterrence, I believed, was the first step on the path towards peace." Now, in order to do this, get this nuclear program up and running, he had to raise, he raised private money
yes.
to get this done. How on earth was he able to do that? I mean, in this day and age, that's just truly incredible and spectacular that you could do something like that and not have anybody know really about it.
Yeah, within the opposition that he had about this project, I mean, people thought that creating Dimona will bring upon ourselves disasters. They believe that the U.S. or Russia or somebody else will discover this project and will ruin the entire area, if not the entire Israel. And they saw a great danger in trying to create this kind of capability within the hands of such a small, tiny little country like Israel. But my father was a great believer and a great dreamer. And whenever he saw something which deserves the service of the cause, he used every bit of optimism and his ability and resilience to overcome every challenge. One of the elements of the opposition was coming from the Minister of Finance, who said, "You will not see a cent from me." So he had to raise money in a private basis, reaching out to those who he could charm and express the importance of the project. And he had this ability to present an idea and conviction and get the funding done at the end of the day. I don't want to spoil the pleasure of reading this book. And I think that if you read the book about this chapter and some other chapters, you'll find that my father really, really climbed very high mountains with a lot of optimism and never gave up in spite of all the setbacks that he had to experience.
Optimism. At any point, though, was he ever concerned that by soliciting donors, he was opening doors to conflicts of interest?
Not at all, not at all. I think he was serving a great cause. He was talking about saving the Jewish people, building a house for the people of Israel. You have to remember that when he looked back on those days, he saw the Holocaust. He saw the weakness of the Jewish people, and he thought that what he's doing is incredibly important in our ability to survive in the area. And my father, through his life, never took a cent to his pocket. Those were days where people served idealism without even thinking about such kinds as conflict of interest. Later on, when the state became stronger and more modern, you started to talk about those kind of things. But those days, it was pure patriotism and fulfilling a dream of creating the state of Israel.
Now, he was able to do all of this in secret, but there was one person who did know what was happening. Talk about your father's meeting with then-President Kennedy about the nuclear program.
Yeah, so the Americans suspected that there was something happening. And one day when my father was, relatively speaking, not in a senior position, he was very young and he was the Director General of the Ministry of Defense and later on the Deputy Minister of the Defense Ministry. And he was paying a visit to the White House. And to some extent, President Kennedy snapped him into the Oval Office and wanted to hear from him the State of the Union, but also at some point in time surprised him with a question about the nuclear facilities. And my father, on the spot, without having the authority to do that, said, "Mr. President, I can rest assured that the state of Israel will not be the first one to introduce nuclear weapon to the Middle East." That ambiguity became the official policy of the state of Israel. And of course, people that were with him were shocked with his boldness about, you know, saying something like that to the president. But he had to do something, and he had to respond, and was very creative and very, very smart. And I think what it did was exactly the right thing. And, of course, through the generations later on, that was Israel's policy.
Yeah, but at the time, what was the reaction back home? That's like having a junior assistant to the president go and make policy on behalf of the nation. What was the reaction back in Israel to your father's optimistic innovation in the heat of the moment?
The only person really that my father it was important for him was David Ben-Gurion, his mentor and a great leader that my father really served through his life and never forgot and always spoke about his leadership. And when he explained Ben-Gurion the situation, Ben-Gurion understood it, and that was enough. He could never convince everyone, but Ben-Gurion's opinion was the most important one. And my father, you know, sometimes when you do things, when you dream and when you execute your dreams, you have to bear the consequences. And he was not afraid to bear the consequences. And he believed that he did the right thing.
How did your father manage the fallout when a few years later, news reports came out about the fact that the government was secretly working on a nuclear program?
Well, they always kept the ambiguity policy. They never really spoke about it. And the truth of the matter is that I don't really know until today what's really happening there. I remember he told me, and I think he wrote about it as well in the book, one day the minister of Foreign Affairs of Egypt met my father somewhere, probably in the World Economic Forum, and said, Shimon, you know, we're friends for many, many years. Why don't you bring me to Dimona and show me what you're doing? I shall never tell anyone what's in there. And he said, Minister of Foreign Affairs, my friend, if I'll take you there, you'll come, you'll see there's nothing there, and you'll be disappointed. So let's keep it as is. And I think the Israeli government really managed to keep the deterrent and that policy, which really the most important part of it is that it allowed us to survive. It allowed us to prevail. It allowed us to continue and build our economic and military powers through the years and bring us to the point where we can really seriously start looking for a long-lasting peace agreement between us and our neighbors. That comes from power, military power, and economic power.
And speaking of neighbors, Iran. What did your father think of Iran's nuclear ambitions?
So the nuclear ambitions is not just something that the Iranians are interested in. There are many other countries around the world, and there is a big challenge for the world to deal with proliferation of such weapons of mass destruction. It's not the only country that we see right now in the news. There are other countries which are posing a threat on world peace. My father believed that the dispute is not between us and the Iranian people. It's really about leadership. And he spoke a lot about leadership. What kind of a leadership is required in today's life? And he looked also back into the Bible, and he said, you know, kings are representing the past, where the prophets are representing the future. In his view, leaders should serve their people. In his view, the leaders should create new possibilities into the future. And my father always spoke about what we see right now is as paying taxes twice. We pay taxes for not living an old world of wars and bloodshed and territories. And we pay taxes again for not entering a new world of opportunities, science, technology, and optimism. So the challenge really is how you switch and how you change this kind of leadership into be forward-looking and recognizing that the old empires of yesterday, the ones that had militaries and went to wars over land and sea, are gone. And the future belongs to the innovators. The future belongs to those who unite and think beyond borders and deal with global challenges such as global economy, global terrorism, job creations, climate change, and there is a long list over there.
What did your father think about former President Obama's agreement with Iran on its nuclear program, say?
My father was. My father believed that what Obama is doing is the right thing. What Obama really did try and succeeded at the end of the day is to create a coalition of parties which were not completely aligned in their interests. And Obama, I believe, also understood that sanctions from all over the world for the long run on the Iranian people is not the right way to go. And there is a limit to that. And he created an amazing kind of a coalition that was never created before, and worked an agreement that its consequences, I believe, will have to be judged in a perspective of many more years, not today. I believe that we need a little bit more perspective. But in general, my father believed that what Obama did was the right thing, to build a coalition and try to negotiate an agreement, and hopefully, over time, we'll take further more steps into the new world, departing and divorcing from the old world, and hopefully Iran will become a member of the modern world and depart from the old world.
Like all leaders, your father was not without his critics. After your father's death, the Israeli historian Tom Segev wrote in the New York Times Sunday Review, as Ben-Gurion's deputy minister of defense, Mr. Peres also held part of the responsibility for the harsh and often arbitrary restrictions that the military imposed on the country's Arab citizens, including extensive land confiscations. And he goes on to write, in 1975, when he was defense minister, Mr. Peres granted permissions to one of the first groups of Israeli settlers to remain in the West Bank. Later, he supported the establishment of several other settlements, laying the first obstacles to the so-called two-state solution. How do you respond to that?
Well, one of the things I learned in the book is, and I said those words from my heart yesterday when I was at Mount Herzl paying tribute, marking the first year of memorial for my father. What I learned from the book is when you serve a great cause, let's say the great cause can be the establishment of a nation, like Ben-Gurion did in 1948, or when you talk about the creation of Dimona, or when you talk about other great things that he did in his life, before you achieve your dream, before you accomplish your mission, there is a lot of dispute, there is a lot of argument between people, because, you know, people object and people see things in a different way, and lots of people are afraid of the consequences that we will experience once this mission was accomplished. But I learned that after a while, when you accomplish that mission, all of us reunite again. The State of Israel was almost not being established because of the opposition Ben-Gurion had about the idea of setting up a state in 1948, when the chances of its sustainability were very, very limited. But still, all of us are happy and unite around the idea that we have a state now. The same happened with the nuclear facility. When my father worked on building it, the whole world was against him. But once we had the establishment of the nuclear facility, today everyone recognizes its contribution to the success of Israel. Now, through the way, there are different disputes, there are different situations, there are mistakes. My father did not say that he's free of mistakes. And I'm not relating to any specific mistake that you just laid in this discussion.
But did he support the settlements in the West Bank?
Initially, yes. Initially, you have to remember that most people really supported the idea of settling, and he did create some cities like Ariel, for example, who most likely in every discussion will stay where it is. My father was a hawkish minister of defense at the beginning, and you have to remember we were fighting for our lives. And the existence of Israel was questioned all the time. So they had to do certain things. But very quickly, he realized that in order to be secured, in order to be safe, in order to achieve our final destination as a nation, we have to be in peace with our neighbors. And from that point on, he gave his life to achieving long-lasting peace. Even the Oslo Accords, which he talks about as well, you know, my father participated in the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel that seems to be impossible, and yet it became possible. The same happened with Jordan. And he laid the foundation to peace agreements with the Palestinians. Still, people think it's impossible, and he thought to his very last second that it is not only possible, it will be done.
Do you think that a two-state solution is possible?
Well, I think that one-state solution is impossible. And I believe that a two-state solution, as an idea, is the only way to go. There is a Palestinian people. There is a Jewish people. We need to recognize each other, just like was done around Oslo Accords. And we have to understand that, unfortunately, two people are sharing our country right now. And we need to find a solution where we can live together and build a different future for our children, for our grandchildren. We need to depart from the old world. We need to stop looking backwards. I'm always saying that there is a political lie in Israel which divides us between right and left. But truth of the matter is, when I talk to my friends in the right side of the political map as well as on the left side, and I'm talking about those who are moderate, I'm not talking about extremes on both sides, what I hear from them is exactly the same. We understand, even Netanyahu, who is not our prime minister and a leader of the right wing, he's talking about two-state solution. But we will not be judged by what we say. We will be judged by what we do. And in my judgment, and my father's, I believe, judgment, it was not a question of right or left. It was a question of whether we move forward or we go backwards. So if we want to live with dignity and respect with our neighbors, they need to have their own solution. We need to have our own state. And we need to work out, based on an agreement between the two of us, what our future is going to look like. And I believe that once we have a peace agreement, we will not even notice that we have borders.
You were saying at the beginning of this interview that your father went through a series of transitions. And I wrote down one thing that you said or that he talked about. One of them was a transition into tomorrow.
Yes.
What did that, quickly, what did that look like to him? What did tomorrow look like?
Tomorrow looked like a future where the young generation can shape their own destiny, a future where there are no wars, a future where borders and territories and land and physical possessions are not important anymore. But what important is our ability to make life affordable for everyone, make life equal for everyone. And my father spoke about the right to be equal, but also about the equal right to be different. And my father wants every child and every boy and girl, whether they are Christians or Muslims or Jews or others, whether they are black or white, whether they are from the left side or from the right side, all of us are human beings and all of us deserve the same future. And he said in one of his great speeches that he would like to see the world free to be free. And that was his great vision. And he worked tirelessly, not only about achieving peace between us and our neighbors or in the region. He spoke to every leader that he met with. And he spoke to every young person that he met with and tried to teach each other, each one of them, to learn from his own experience that we can do it differently, that we can live a different life. He said optimist and pessimist die the same way, but they live completely different lives. And that was the vision of my father. When my father recognized, and this is something I learned when I read the book after he passed away, he knew that his days are numbered. And he knew that at some point in time, his physical ability to meet other people and talk to them is about to be ended. And this is why he wrote this book. Now, this is a voice to be carried. And when you read the book, you should read it with your eyes into the future. Learn from his tools. Learn from his ideas. But really, don't look back, only into the future.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate, and I've been speaking with Chemi Peres, the son of former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres, who completed his memoir just a few weeks before he died. The book is called No Room for Small Dreams, Courage, Imagination, and the Making of Modern Israel. Chemi, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.